Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Oftentimes, booming cities and towns have difficulties in keeping up with the demand and need for municipal services. Growing pains, everything from utilities to policing. Today on the program, we look at the opposite end of the spectrum, though. What towns and cities do when their economy is in decline, their tax base is eroding, and deficits are beginning to accumulate. For some municipalities, it's dissolution, destruction of the municipal government. You might be surprised to know that in the last decade, nearly as many cities and towns dissolved in the U.S. as was created. Well, that certainly interested my guest today, legal scholar Michelle Wild Anderson, an assistant professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, and currently a visiting professor at Stanford Law School. She'll be giving the 6th annual Judge Stephanie Seymour Lecture in Law tonight at 6 o'clock at the University of Tulsa Law School on her recent legal article, Dissolving Cities. She found that while our laws about municipal dissolution were written about a century ago, and they were designed to accommodate towns that were disappearing or becoming ghost towns, but today dissolution is coming about despite having sizable populations in place. Michelle Wild Anderson is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Michelle Anderson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
Now, you're going to be talking about dissolving cities, and it was an interesting statistic that opens a legal article you wrote recently that over about the past dozen years, we've lost as many cities, and when I say cities, that means everything from villages, townships, incorporated towns and cities. We've lost about as many as we've actually created. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. I think dissolution is a real phenomenon. It's strange that we haven't talked more about it, but dissolution is a phenomenon by which cities and the population in a city decides to strip away the legal status of the town. So they eliminate their government. They eliminate the city borders. They sell the city's assets or transfer them to a county. And it shifts the community to reliance on the county government. And it's an extraordinary thing that is spiking in recent years, but has been around for decades.
Now, what got you interested in this? I understand it's a connection here to Oklahoma.
Yeah, I started coming across records of small southern towns, including some all-black towns in Oklahoma that were struggling financially and going through deep population loss and long-term economic slide. So I became particularly interested in what happens as a legal matter, as a governmental matter in these towns when the community has essentially lost so much ground that people have to start asking existential questions about whether the township continues to exist.
So you started seeing these black townships, which some of them came in after the Civil War because they were the freed slaves of the Indian tribes. Others came in right after statehood and the land runs, and they were sort of the promised land townships.
Right.
And, of course, those conditions have changed because of economic opportunity. Right. They really were economically segregated as well as racially segregated. And now with desegregation, a lot of the reason for those towns have gone away, other than the heritage of the town.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Oklahoma has an extraordinary history and actually a very proud history of settlement in all-black towns. And as you say, the initial settlement in the – actually, even before the Civil War and then a period of even greater growth after the Civil War – these towns marked shelter and survival for – people who were fleeing lynchings in the South, racial violence more broadly, racial discrimination across the South, hoping that Oklahoma would become a sort of a safer frontier for freed blacks. And the all-black towns movement was an extraordinary history of communities coming together to support one another, to create economic interdependencies within their community, to allow blacks to exercise a political franchise, and essentially in some accounts to prove to the broader white southern community that African Americans could sustain political independence and responsibility. And they just have an extraordinary history. And they suffered a great deal across Oklahoma's turn to statehood, in which Jim Crow segregation was enshrined in the state
constitution. The very first thing we did,
1906. And Well, and sort of around that period of time, Oklahoma went the way of the bigger South in terms of racially restrictive covenants and economic exclusion practices. So these towns became quite economically isolated, and then they were hit by many of the ravages of the Great Depression that hit so many towns in Oklahoma. You had the Dust Bowl, you had the any kind of economic shock, like a railroad closure or longer-term out-migration in search of employment elsewhere. So these towns shrank in population, and some of them disintegrated altogether and became what we would think of as ghost towns. And some of them are still around, and you use the beautiful word heritage, I think, for many of them, sort of the heritage and this proud history of ancestors sort of trying to make an independent life outside of Southern racism was just an extraordinary, it's an extraordinary and quite beautiful history.
Yet some of those towns did not survive. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the central themes, I think, of your work is the reason for why cities dissolve is the fact that it doesn't matter if you're a river port and all of a sudden the railroad makes the river irrelevant, or you're a railroad town that now the interstate makes irrelevant.
Right.
There's reason for decline, and decline's one of the major reasons a city will basically pull the plug on itself and go back to county rule.
That's right. And actually being here in Oklahoma, sort of a western frontier town, you're reminded that urban growth is not an upward ratchet. Towns can grow and they can die back down. This is a place with so many hamlets and settlements that for many reasons didn't make it into the 21st century. And that's a big part of what dissolution is about, is creating a legal mechanism by which the law and local government can recognize that there is no meaningful town left. But I also write in this project about a lot of towns that remain quite populated, even if they are a shadow of their former population. There's still thousands of people there, tens of thousands of people there, who are asking what the next generation of their community looks like, and essentially asking whether government needs to be part of that. Do you need a government to signify a community? Do you need a government to preserve a history? Do your relationships with your neighbors have anything to do with whether you have a city council?
Now, one of the cities I think that you followed is actually a village, the village of Seneca Falls, New York. Now, people are saying Seneca Falls, that sounds familiar for some reason. This was like the birthplace of the suffrage movement and the temperance movement in the 1800s.
Yeah, there too, a proud and fascinating history. Seneca Falls was a great industrial upstart in the Northeast. It was a growing river port town in the 19th century, and it was and it went through kind of an early boom, a major industrial expansion, and then for whatever reason, it just didn't become one of the major industrial giants of the East. It was sort of it was surpassed by Rochester and other places.
Now, it was based on a canal there, right?
Right.
And I suppose the railroad didn't really come there, or didn't come there as other than a spur line, and all of a sudden that industry moves elsewhere.
Right. The commerce patterns just didn't favor Seneca Falls in the longer term. And so the city shrank, and it's now a small town. It's not a poor small town, although it's in a larger region that has suffered economically a great deal. But Seneca Falls took a vote on dissolution and eliminated their village government, and essentially decided that they didn't need this additional tier of government over them, that they could revert to the town. New York has towns that govern rural places, and the village of Seneca Falls dissolved into its town and passed its affairs on to this larger unit of government.
So they really weren't losing a lot as far as city government, because they were basically an enclave within a town, basically.
Right. I think they were choosing the town as their government. They were so in that case, it's right that essentially they were substituting the village government for the town. But it's also true that they were that instead of being governed by both tiers of government, the town and the village, they were stripping out the lower level. And that's typical of dissolutions across the country, that dissolution represents a choice to pass more of your affairs to the county government. But because of some early interpretation of the U.S. Constitution, residents of a city already have a right to vote in county politics or town politics, depending on the state. And so really, this is about having one tier of government rather than two. Or one tier of local government, I should say, rather than two, or two tiers rather than three. It's about actually eliminating a level.
And you know, I actually see this in a lot of large cities where the city is spread around a township that perhaps was separate at one point, but you know, urban growth has sort of swallowed it up. And in some places, you'll see these towns with their own little police force, their own little municipal government. Other times, like I think in Tulsa, I'm not sure if things like Dawson, these are little communities, little townships, whether they were incorporated or not, but the city pretty much swallowed them up easily. You know, I mean, there was no separate government. But it seems like that would be a pretty good efficiency of government. Is that what citizens are responding to?
That's exactly the theory. The idea is that this is a historic and perhaps obsolete form of government, these villages or old towns, and we don't, or townships, we don't need them anymore. They don't conform to population patterns. They don't conform to economic patterns anymore. And so let's just kind of sweep away the underbrush of additional administration and try to rationalize the way that services are provided and the city is governed. That's definitely the theory. The truth is that we don't know very much about whether dissolutions actually do save people money. We don't know whether the decision to remove a smaller government reduces people's tax load over the long run. And that might seem odd. Maybe it seems like, of course it would. And it's true that you lay off your politicians and you lay off your employees. You shift those service responsibilities to the county. But it's a little more complicated than that because local governments compete with one another through their land use policy. So when you dissolve a city, you also give up the right to control land use in your jurisdiction. And if land use was the main way that you promoted economic development, or you competed for the shopping mall, or you competed for new growth, then perhaps dissolution could mean for some of these areas static property tax rates or the larger household costs associated with one government or another. We just really don't know. We need to do longitudinal research on what happens to these cities after dissolution.
My guest today is Michelle Wild Anderson, an assistant professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, currently a visiting professor at Stanford Law School. She'll be giving the 6th Judge Stephanie Seymour Lecture in Law today at 6 o'clock at the University of Tulsa Law School on this whole idea of dissolving cities, which I guess this is the first big piece of research on dissolving cities in a lot of years. I think you said most of what scant evidence there is about research about how to dissolve a city as far as the legal theories is 100 years old or so. I was really fascinated in the reasons a city or a town or a village will decide to dissolve. Obviously, decline is one, and we've talked about some of the reasons there. When you look in the High Plains, you look at, you know, when you're driving through the High Plains, you'll go through a little township that was once a big agricultural city, and you can see, you can just see the writing on the wall for a lot of these towns. But there's another type of city that will tend to dissolve, and that has to do with boom towns. And you can go through Oklahoma where there were boom towns that are just ghost towns today. I would think with the huge real estate bubble in California, your home state, you're seeing a lot of towns consider dissolution there because property values have collapsed. The whole function of local government isn't supported anymore because of, you know, declining population, foreclosure. Are you seeing the same thing there? Is that a big issue where cities are considering dissolution?
California has definitely taken a big hit in the housing bubble, and there's no question that we've seen a lot of a sharp decline in some areas. Because of the way dissolution law is structured in California, counties have the right in California to interject and to try to avoid a dissolution of a poor city. So as it turns out, dissolution is not as important in California as municipal bankruptcy has become or other forms of restructuring that a local government could go through in the face of a recession. So in my home state, there is absolutely the same human history of boomtown and decline. The legal history is a little bit less interesting when it comes to dissolution than in other states.
Well, you bring up an interesting point where a town has grown too fast, too quick, and can't support itself. All of a sudden, if you dissolve, all of a sudden, all those costs are transferred to a larger governmental source, be it, you know, a borough or a county. Seems like that would be a burden on the county.
It is. I mean, imagine what it's like to be a government official for a county or the lawyer for the county council, and you watch a dissolution vote taking place in a city with no control or influence over it. And at the end of that vote, if the dissolution succeeds, essentially a series of boxes will be delivered to the county, including all of the city's leases, including all of its service obligations and contracts, resumes of all of the city's employees for the county to consider rehiring. I mean, administratively, it's incredibly complicated and burdensome on the county, not to mention the fact that whatever the structural reasons that the city struggled, that whatever reasons were causing stress economically for the city, those problems will essentially get passed to the county's finances. And the county may be able to cut costs and the county may be able to provide services more efficiently. That's the hope of dissolutions. But in states where counties can't exercise a choice over dissolution, they have to go through the administrative transition whether or not they think that it'll be better off in the long run.
Now, that brings us to our second example that you write about. That's the story of Miami, Florida, which unsuccessively tried to dissolve in
the 1990s.
And in this case, it was a series of corruption. It was high taxes. And it was also, as you write, sort of a covertly a chance for wealthier communities within the city to basically dissolve themselves from the larger city, maybe create their own city in the wake of the dissolution, which sort of basically says, well, the poor sections, they can go fend for themselves. That, it sounds like it was a good thing that that didn't pass, but that sounds kind of, well, it doesn't sound very seemly, actually.
Miami is a very surprising example of a dissolution attempt. It was rejected at the polls by voters. But in 1996, some wealthy neighborhoods within Miami started advocating for dissolution of the entire city. And just as you suggest, that the idea was that if these neighborhoods could strip away Miami as a city, then they would be back in the unincorporated area of Dade County. They would be back in the bigger sea of unincorporated Dade. And once they were there, incorporation law would allow them to form their own cities without permission from the rest of Miami, because incorporation law doesn't require the consent of the residents not included in the new city's territory. So this what was going on in Miami was essentially a two-step incorporation movement. It was a way to form new cities by breaking apart the bigger, older city, and then your fate is in your own hands. The neighborhoods would be able to make their own cities, and it was defeated at the polls. I think because the larger population in Miami saw that it was
pretty
anti,
transparently. Yeah.
Yeah, they saw that this would ultimately hurt the larger urban area of Miami economically. There was a deeply held view, which I think is a correct one, that these neighborhoods within Miami were part of the economic apparatus of the city. They're part of urban metropolitan Miami. They are commuters who work in the city. They're part of the city's economic engine. And so there was a strong view that they should also be part of the political entity of the city of Miami. They should pay their taxes into the city of Miami and be part of the administrative body of the city in which they worked and lived.
Now, one of your reasons for dissolution is this whole idea of tax revolt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is this because of extraordinary taxation, or is it just the run-of-the-mill city taxes that are sort of fueling efforts? And you list a whole line of cities, mainly pretty conservative areas. Is this an important issue as far as, and are they successful at all?
Right. Yeah, there is a really interesting line of cities that have dissolved or put dissolution on their local ballots in the name of stopping, quote unquote, double taxation. The idea that we shouldn't have to pay taxes to the city and the town or the city and the county. Instead, let's streamline government and just remove this other administration. And those movements definitely, I think, built steam in the context of the larger rise of the Tea Party and the anti-tax rhetoric in this particular decade. We've been through, you know, several rounds of anti-tax animus over recent decades, but the current sort of iteration of that with the Tea Party has brought out a fair number of dissolutions. And they have interesting names like Operation Eagle Freedom in Eagle, Wisconsin, which is sort of summoning the Liberty card to describe what it meant to get rid of your government. And I think it also evoked this idea of killing a government, that it was exhilarating in some ways to eliminate a tier of government. And, you know, really one of the only places you can do that is at the village or city level. But as I say, you know, all of this needs a footnote that we really don't know if they're right. We don't actually know if it will save those towns' taxes in the end. And many of those dissolution drives were defeated because residents felt like taxes were not as important as community and history and regulatory control of your area.
It's interesting, some of the reasons for towns and cities to consider. I was struck by the example of Max Creek, Missouri, which basically existed as a speed trap, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
And when the state of Missouri changed the speed trap laws, all of a sudden they couldn't afford their extensive police force along the interstate, and they found themselves in deficit conditions. Did they actually dissolve?
Max Creek went through a dissolution and a bankruptcy attempt, and actually in that it is similar to an Oklahoma town that filed for bankruptcy.
We've had a speed trap law, too, and there are several communities.
The reform. I think in Oklahoma it had to do with what percentage of a city's revenue could be derived from speeding tickets.
I think that may be either Roland, in far eastern Oklahoma. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would call that kind of story a legal shock. It's a change in the law that means that the way the city made its money, the way the city raised its revenue, is no longer legal. And so all of a sudden, as of a single election, the city has to ask whether it's financially sustainable without raising a lot of taxes. These speed trap towns are one example of that. A city can also be hit with a huge lawsuit that sends it deep into the hole. So even a wealthy city, if it gets hit with a major damages award, can need to reconsider its solvency over the long run. And those shocks can be a cause for dissolution. They can also be a cause for Chapter 9 municipal bankruptcy in the states that allow that.
I was also interested to see in your list of the graveyard of American cities, one was the family-run fiefdom. And it's hard to believe that in this day and age there might be, you know, the equivalent of company towns or basically one family running a small town. Well, maybe not so crazy, but it seems like that day is past in American history. But in fact, That still occurs?
Yeah, that was the city of Vernon in California. And Vernon is a pure industrial city. So there's essentially no housing in Vernon. There are a couple of units, maybe 30 or 40 units of housing downtown that were revealed to be essentially shells so that the few voting residents in the city and the few politicians could have a purported address in Vernon. But nobody wants to live there because of the air pollution, because of the smells, because of the noise, the diesel exhaust, et cetera. It's truly a city that encloses is nothing more than industry. And an enormous corruption scandal was revealed, and the state threatened Vernon with dissolution.
And this is the town in California people heard in the news where you had town officials making over $1 million a year.
Right. Yeah, there were two scandals right at the same time, Bell, California, and Vernon, California. Bell is actually quite populated, lives downwind of some of Vernon, in fact, Vernon's industry, in fact. But Vernon was truly a fiefdom. It is hard to believe it exists, but I'm sure it's not alone in the country as one of these sort of early, a city incorporated sheerly for the purposes of stripping business taxes down to the bone.
Very quickly, in our last couple seconds here, it sounds like we need to actually do more legal research and perhaps recodify laws about how you stop a city as much as how you create one.
That's right. I think we need machinery to help. We need legal machinery, procedures, and standards to help communities dismantle their government when it's no longer working anymore, when they can't sustain themselves financially. Law has to provide a transition pathway to a new governmental model. And I think that is merely a modernization project. It's merely an effort to bring dissolution law into the 21st century, to allow dissolution law to serve not only the ghost towns where there's truly nothing left, but to also serve those populated communities that decide they simply want a new government.
Is most of our current law geared towards those ghost towns?
That's right. Most of dissolution law is written as though the only reason you would want to dissolve is because there are truly no voters left. 50 or 100 person population limits. So there are many states where you simply can't dissolve if you have more than 100 people. So I think modernizing dissolution law requires rethinking some of those numbers and establishing procedures and standards for transitioning.
Professor Anderson, thanks for your time.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Michelle Wild Anderson is an assistant professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, and a visiting professor at Stanford Law School. She'll be giving the 6th Judge Stephanie Seymour Lecture in Law today at 6 o'clock at the University of Tulsa Law School, talking about dissolving cities. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent shows, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for Studio Tulsa, and you can search our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.